Greetings, everyone. How are you? Who do we have on the line?
Hi, Sharon. This is Jen from CWS. I'm on. I think most people are on a soft mute, so they can speak if they unmute themselves by pressing *6, but I've muted most folks just so we can not have too much white noise.
Great.
Jen?
Great.
This is Terry. Am I muted?
This is Tony from Tucson.
I can hear you now.
Okay.
Hi, Terry. This is Sharon Stanley-Ray. We're so delighted to have you with us on the call today.
Thank you. I'm excited.
I am, too.
Hi, this is Tonya from Tucson.
Hello, Tonya. How are you?
Doing pretty well.
Good. Thank you for joining us. We'll get started in just a few minutes.
Okay.
Hi, this is Rebecca Brown in Columbus with Peace Catalyst International.
Great. We're glad you're on. We had about 250 folks register, so I think that Jen is going to shift us on to mute in a moment as a number of people start coming on. If you are a speaker, just to make sure you're not on mute, you can hit *6. Hello, do we have folks joining in?
I think we have a ton of folks on the line, Sharon, but I just remuted folks. So I think folks are on, and I took off the entry and exit time so that we could have a good entry, but we've got a ton of folks on.
Excellent. Okay, well, we will continue to wait for just a few moments because we know we have a very high number of attendees for this call. And again, for those who are on but on mute, know that we are thrilled to have you be a part of this call. We're also excited very much about our speakers who are going to be presenting. So we'll introduce them in just a couple of moments. Thank you again for joining. If you're getting ready to join in also, we remind you that you can see audio visuals by going to http://join.me/faith, F-A-I-T-H, 4, and then the word immigration, http://join.me/faith4immigration. And that way you'll be able to see the PowerPoint slide that our speakers will be following as well as hear them. We'll get started in just a moment. We hope that you're able to see the PowerPoint slide as it's pulling up as well. And Jen, I'm having a little bit of technical difficulty myself getting the screen to come up. I'm going to try again.
Okay, let me know, Sharon. Thanks.
Yeah, but I have the final version so I can we can communicate maybe in another way if need be.
Can others see the visual PowerPoint on their screen? You'll have to press star 6 to unmute to answer me.
Yeah, I can. Sonia in Tucson, I can see it.
I can see
Great.
It.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Do you need the webcam?
No, it's not necessary.
Yeah.
Not necessary to use the webcam in order to view the slides.
Okay.
Yeah. That way we can see you.
We are seeing a bunch of beautiful faces, and if you want to be seen, then that is great. If you're thinking, oh, maybe I don't want to be seen, you can go and you can click the dot, dot, dot at the bar, the join.me bar at the top of your screen, and I think you can deselect the video connection.
Cool.
Or if you're having trouble, you can just put a piece of tape over your webcam on your laptop.
Use that high-tech solution. All right. Well, I think we will go ahead and get started. Again, you are reminded, of course, you can call in and just listen to us via audio, but if you would like to link to the visual link, it's http://join.me/faith4immigration. Welcome on behalf of all of us who are members of the Interfaith Immigration Coalition, a team of 47 interfaith partners who work with national organizations and denominational representative offices. We are grateful to have you each join with us because you are essential partners in continuing to raise up voices of faith communities and helping to support refugees and immigrants, and most especially in this very vital time. As you know, this week is important, perhaps in a way that nearly no other week in our American history has been, to offer support to the U.S. refugee program, and most importantly, to enable us, as the U.S. refugee program is supported, to continue to provide a great uplift and encouragement to refugees throughout the world who are the world's most vulnerable communities, with 20 million refugees in the world and over 4 million just Syrian refugees. There is no time as important as this to be weighing in our voices. And today's topic is most especially important as we work to learn about the state of play for how we can, through our voices, have a critical role in ensuring the U.S. refugee program is not compromised by votes that could take place as early as this week, and also to ensure that we as faith communities are understanding very carefully anti-refugee voices and, sadly, anti-Syrian and anti-Muslim voices that have been unfortunately getting far too much play and airtime in our society recently. We're joined for the conversations today by Jen Smyers, Director of Policy and Advocacy at Church World Service, working with the Immigration and Refugee Program. And we're particularly delighted to have as well Terry Johnson, who is with us as the Executive Director of the Center for New Community. Terry will be walking us through some of the organizations that continue, sadly, to fan the flames of fear and of discrimination against our Muslim communities, our friends, our partners, our neighbors. And Catherine Orsborn will be plugging in with us. She is, we can say, in this moment in a meeting together with Department of Homeland Security staff, and will be pulling out of that to present to us, as well as the campaign director for the Shoulder to Shoulder program that links together Muslim and non-Muslim communities in faith efforts and to promote anti-Muslim sentiment. Again, we're grateful for each member who is here. And Jen, we will turn the floor over to you now in this critical moment to help us know the difference that our faith communities make, and we certainly began to, especially last week, feel that difference as we saw minds again changing and becoming more open. Help us know what we need to do now.
Great. Thank you so much, Sharon, and thanks to everyone who's on. Really appreciate the time and the work that all of you are doing, some Syrian refugees in particular across the country. So some of this might be repeat for those of you who have been living through it, but wanted to provide a little bit of context. We all know that on November 13th, there were terrorist attacks in Paris, and initially there was a rumor when all of the facts of the situation were coming into play that one of the people involved in the attacks was a Syrian refugee, and that has now come to be proven that that is not the case. The individual did have a Syrian passport on his person, but it was not his passport. It was a passport of a Syrian man who has been deceased for quite some time now. So, however, it really changed the entire rhetoric of the world, really, and particularly the United States when it comes to Syrian refugees. Really, in short succession, 31 now governors announced that their states will not accept Syrian refugees, and we've seen some of those governors, roll back that a little bit, and then other governors double down and say that they, will not issue any sorts of benefits to refugees. We know that in Indiana there has been a lawsuit filed on behalf of Exodus Refugee Ministries that specifically says, you are asking us, governors, to exercise discrimination, basically, in terms of who we let in. It's certainly against the law to discriminate against someone based on their nationality in terms of them coming into a state or in terms of them accessing benefits. We know that the Texas governor, Governor Abbott, has actually filed a lawsuit against the federal government to prevent Syrian refugees from coming in, and they've also filed a lawsuit against the International Rescue Committee, and those lawsuits are continuing. There was some backtracking on behalf of the Texas government recently. The Texas governor recently, he kind of backtracked on a restraining order that he had also filed, but those two lawsuits are still pending. And we know that there are likely to be other lawsuits, especially in states that are doubling down, because, again, this amounts to discrimination. And also, of course, immigration policies and refugee resettlement are implemented by the federal government. So then, on the national stage, the House of Representatives just last week passed H.R. 4038, the so-called American Faith Act. And this is a bill that, especially because it went through the House of Representatives so quickly, it was actually being discussed in committee at the same time that it was being voted on the floor of the House of Representatives. So it was not really given a lot of time to be discussed. I think some members voted for this under the assumption that it was just adding a few layers of security. But in fact, this is a bill that would grind to a halt the resettlement of not only Syrian refugees, but also Iraqi refugees and any refugee of any nationality who has set foot in Iraq or Syria since March of 2011. And the reason for this is because the language in the bill calls for each applicant for refugee status from Iraq or Syria or people who have traveled to those countries, for each
single case to be certified personally by the FBI director, the DHS, Department of Homeland Security Secretary, and the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General. And it was very clear from the statements of Representative Michael McCaul, the sponsor of the bill, that this authority could not be delegated to people under those national security figureheads, but they themselves had to certify each and every case to 12 different congressional committees. And obviously, it goes without saying that our top intelligence and national security officials have a lot of work to do. That's very important. And, you know, poring over cases for hours is certainly not a good use of their time or resources, but also because we know that the security checks for refugees are the strongest in the world in the United States. We know that refugees are the most highly vetted individuals to travel to the United States, and each of the security check processes is time limited. So it means that while, you know, a refugee case is waiting on the desk of FBI Director Comey or DHS Secretary Johnson's desk, those validity periods for the other parts of the security check process will be expiring. So again, it's very important for us to get the word out that this legislation does not add any more security, because the FBI and Department of Homeland Security are already part and parcel of this process. In fact, it would just grind to a halt to the resettlement of Syrian and Iraqi refugees. And it should be said for Iraqi refugees that, of course, includes individuals who served alongside U.S. interests. So I wanted to put up here the security check process, some helpful links the White House has put together, and I'll put it in the chat function on the webinar once I finish talking here. But they've put together a very helpful infographic that goes through the variety of stages of the security check process. And they've also put together a video that's narrated by DHS Secretary Johnson that goes through the process that can be a helpful tool. And recently, I think many of you are on the Interfaith Immigration Coalition listserv. I was helpfully and validly called to task about why so much language around security. And, you know, it's absolutely true that as people of faith, we need to be talking about people's value, people's dignity, the importance of the Refugee Resettlement Program as a life-saving program, our relationships with people who are refugees, and the value that is brought to our country as we welcome people who are fleeing persecution. First and foremost, we need to be talking about those relationships and those people. But right now, I know that many of us are being asked these questions about the security checks, so I hope that this is helpful. But again, of course, it shouldn't be our, you know, number one talking point. But just to reiterate this as a helpful tool, refugees go through biometric screenings, medical tests, interagency name and biography checks, forensic document testing, in-person interviews with Department of Homeland Security officials, DNA testing for any type of family reunification applications, and these are all vetted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Department of Homeland Security, Department of State, Department of Defense, and the National Counterterrorism Center, among other agencies as well. So these can be helpful resources as you're all getting questions about these things and wanting to answer them, and then also, of course, pivoting to the very, very important role, life-saving role, of the Refugee Resettlement Program. So we're asking everyone, of course, to take action, to call your representatives, to call your senators, and to call your governors as well, especially on that, if they're on that 31 list. And you'll see at this link below and on the Interfaith Immigration Coalition's website that we have an updated action alert urging people to make these calls, to send this alert to your networks, your neighbors, your friends, your classmates, your everyone, and have them make these calls. It's so important. Right now, not only is this House legislation being considered on the Senate side, but both the House and the Senate are considering adding this negative legislation and other pieces of negative legislation that would stop Syrian resettlement, to the Omnibus Appropriations Bill. And I know that that's really wonky, talking about the omnibus, but it's basically when Congress puts all of the different appropriations funding bills into one big package and passes it. They have to pass that bill by December 11th. And so because it's a must-pass piece of legislation, it's a very, very real threat to the refugee resettlement program if it's going to be, if some of this negative legislation is attached to that omnibus bill. So we need to be very clear when we call our members of Congress, when we meet with them, that we want them to oppose any legislation or policy riders to this omnibus bill that would stop, pause, or defund the resettlement of Syrian refugees. And this is critical.
What was the name of the bill again?
So the bill is called the American SAFE Act, and I think the SAFE stands for Security Against Foreign Entities, I believe is the acronym, and the number is 4038, H.R. 4038. But I will say, I know we're all used to making these calls and talking about the bill number. I think the difference in this situation is that that bill and the bill number might become a policy rider and just attached to this funding bill. So, you know, we can definitely mention it and then, you know, immediately after say we're against this bill, H.R. 4038, and we're against any legislation or policy rider that would stop, pause, or defund the resettlement of Syrian refugees. So this is a critical moment not only for our Syrian American brothers and sisters and community members who are awaiting reunification with their family members, but also for the thousands of Syrian refugees who are in camps in Jordan, millions really, who are in Lebanon, who are in Egypt, who are in Turkey, who are seeking safety in Europe. And, you know, the administration has said that 10,000 can come this year and seek protection. And we know that this program is secure, and we know that this program is life-saving. And in the United States of America, we can do both. We can protect our security, and we can also make sure that we're extending welcome to people who are fleeing persecution. And we have all seen these powerful pictures of children and families who are fleeing the persecution of ISIS, the civil war in Syria, and we really need to be able to stand with them, and we need to make sure that Congress hears from us that we're standing in solidarity with Syrian refugees and that we support the refugee resettlement program. So now is really a critical time. I know we always say that, but it's really, really true. Congress has to pass this bill by December 11th. There's a slight chance they might bump it to next week and kind of give themselves a little wiggle room, but they have to pass it or the government's going to shut down, right? And so we need to be heard on this, and we need to make sure that that when they go home on December 18th for a little holiday break, that they have not done damage, real damage, to the refugee resettlement program. So I just want to say thank you to everyone. One last thing that I'll mention here. So if you go to the Interfaith Immigration Coalition website, we've added a new page, and this is welcoming refugees state by state. You'll see we have a bunch of national resources that we've linked here, and then we've also done each and every state. And if you click on your state, you'll see different letters to the editor, opinion editorials, events that people of faith have put on. You'll see links to refugee resettlement sites. You'll see a whole host of great materials. If you know something great has happened in your state that shows the welcome of Syrian refugees and it's not there, please let us know. Any of us, let us know. I'll put up Hannah and Megan's email, who are updating this regularly, but just send it to the listserv. If you're on the listserv, get it to one of us. We'll put it up there. We want to make sure that everyone knows what great work is being done by people of faith across the country in every state to welcome Syrian refugees, and I am personally sending personalized emails to every single Senate and House office, making sure that they know what people are doing in their state to welcome Syrian refugees, because we know that the political rhetoric surrounding Syrian refugees is not indicative of the welcome that is felt for them across the country. So with that, I will turn it back over to Sharon.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you so much for the state of play and review of the important and critical information and votes that are potentially to be taking place this week, and especially for the call again to everyone on this call to keep calling your governors and especially now your senators and your congressional leaders. And we will again return to the information of the important links that you mentioned a bit ago towards the end of our call as well. At this time, we want to turn to Terry Johnson. Again, Terry is the executive director for the Center for New Community that tracks organized bigotry. It equips, as you see on your screen, grassroots movements to mobilize, to fight against the negative rhetoric that is continuing to be built up from other sources in opposition to refugees. So Terry, help us understand the primary players who are intentionally continuing to strengthen a movement against Muslim communities, and help us know what we can do to make sure we are indeed building a very strong counter voice.
Thank you, Sharon. I will do my best. I want to thank everyone for taking their time to participate in this really important call, and I hope that I can add some analysis and some reflection on the larger climate for the social justice work that we're going to have to do in both the immediate, the short term, and the long term. If I could have the next slide. The Center for New Community has been around since 1995, and the work is grounded in what is called nativism. And nativism is a racist ideology, and it targets immigrants and anybody who is perceived as foreign to the dominant culture. Nativist groups consider those targeted to be a threat to white dominance, and they support discrimination based on language, physical features, or cultural or religious practices. And nativism often swells during moments of increased immigration and economic recession. And it's exacerbated by perceived threats to national security. I'd also like to note that it also rears its ugly head during election season. And so we're sitting at the vortex of all three of those things. Organized nativism, and this is a distinction that we make often in the work that we do because we spend a lot of time studying the organized movements of hatred. And this is the ideological backbone of the organized anti-immigrant as well as the anti-Muslim movements. And they have a clear objective, and I think it's important for us to echo this. It's informed by their history and their actions presently. And fundamentally what they're trying to do is maintain a white majority in the United States. And if they can't have that majority, they're going to make sure that they keep the power out of the hands of anyone who does not meet that criteria. They have a lot of distinct traits, and they work in a lot of the similar ways of the other movements, the anti-black racism movements that have preceded these racist contacts. But they play on some unique fears within the country, and they convince people that immigrants are invaders and they're infiltrators, they're dangerous, they're akin to disease. And you'll hear that in the language often. And we know that when you can convince people that there's a population who actually threatens not only the values of American society, but also the health and safety of our society, it's much easier to convince people to support discriminatory policy. And for some, unfortunately, to take matters into their own hands, as we've seen with vigilante violence and other forms of targeted aggression. The same fears about immigrants are used against Muslim communities. Antis also, employ all three forms of nativism, and that's political, religious, and racial. Some examples of how that works is in the political sphere, Islam is described as a political system based on dominating the West, and therefore every act is seen as subversive. In the religious context, like the past when we marginalized Catholics and Jewish communities, the now religious argument is that the bad guys are Muslim. In the racial context, Muslims have been racialized. They're thought of as Middle Eastern. They're thought of as other. And it's also how other communities who are merely perceived to be Muslim, you don't have to be Muslim to be attacked in this way, but are targeted by that same anti-Muslim bigotry. Now, what we know from the work that we've been doing for the last 20 years to get to know these movements is that they can be stopped. They are strong, but once we collectively call them out, once we expose not only their disturbing backgrounds, but also their discriminatory impact, and I can't stress that enough, we have to be able to be clear about the impact of this rhetoric, the impact of the amount of time and energy that they spend crafting these messages, because that is where it has impact on real lives. But once we do that, we can, in fact, marginalize them. We have done that successfully in the anti-immigrant movement, and we can uplift the values that support the more inclusive, the more equitable society, the more just society that we all want. Please change the slide. The anti-Muslim organized movement, or the Islamophobia movement, is driven by a tight core of activists and self-styled experts. These individuals are more than just casually linked. They often share mutual funders and board members. They work under the same umbrella organizations. They author joint reports, host joint conferences, and often appear together on panels and at public events. The three major ones are the David Horowitz Freedom Center, the Center for Security Policy, and ACT for America. And you'll note that while they are young, they're not all funded or founded in a post-9/11 world. So a couple of ideas about how these people work and some names for you to remember. We have the American Freedom Law Center, and they claim to practice public policy lawfare against Muslim groups and in defense of anti-Muslim rhetoric. This group's co-founder, David Yerushalmi, has emerged as a legal mastermind of this movement. He's the architect of anti-Sharia model legislation that has been passed in at least 9 states and is introduced in more than 30 states since 2010. Headed by Frank Gaffney, the Center for Security Policy is a think tank. It's responsible for manufacturing fear about Muslims and Islam, all couched in the supposed interest of national security. Gaffney's group is a main component of the conspiracy theory that the Muslim Brotherhood has infiltrated the U.S. government at all levels and is secretly controlling it from within. The group has co-authored reports with movement mainstays like John Guandolo, who is a former FBI agent who is working very closely to train sheriffs and other people working on the border on a lot of anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim activity. And Gaffney holds close ties to other anti-immigrant groups like the Center for Immigration Studies and Numbers USA. ACT for America is an anti-Muslim grassroots organization, and it claims to have more than 279,000 members and over 800 U.S. chapters and a handful of international chapters. This group, led by Bridget Gabriel, organizes efforts to lobby legislators, to push anti-Sharia laws, and to influence local law enforcement and national security agencies. Next slide, please. The American Freedom Defense Initiative and the Stop Islamization of America are partner agencies, and they're led by Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer, and they sponsor incendiary ad campaigns on public transit systems, promote anti-Muslim rallies. Ground Zero Mosque Rally and Mosque Opposition in Tennessee are two examples of that, and they use their respective blogs as platforms to demonize Muslims and to advance conspiracy theories. Next slide, please. So fundamentally, both the anti-immigrant movement and the Islamophobia movement use similar processes and strategies to advance their agenda. They work heavily in policy. So some examples of how the Islamophobia anti-Muslim movement work is they will attack things like local sanctuary city designations. They have one example of a federal process was the Vitter Birthright Citizenship Bill. They will do something on the local level, like banning including positive mentions of Islam in textbooks. In the refugee-specific example, CIS issued a report claiming that it costs 5 times as much to resettle a Syrian refugee in the United States as compared to a neighboring country. They used misleading stats. They only looked at the first 5 years, not the economic output of these refugees. The Tennessee legislator pursued a similar economic angle, but the report that they commissioned found that refugees in Tennessee actually added to the state's economy. So while they're introducing policy and while they're actively testifying and while they're making sure that there is something that supports their agenda working against people, and again, in their day-to-day lives, they're also doing constant media messaging. And I can't stress enough how well-funded and how rigorous and how disciplined they are about sending the messages that they think will transform the public discourse. So they are constantly blogging. They are constantly placing op-eds all about no-go zones, messages about how the border is not secure, anti-Sharia law is often used. They are on TV a lot. They testify in front of other people. CIS has testified in Congress over 20 times. They use other elected officials and other candidates as messengers. Again, examples with the refugee issue. They're also often on Fox News talking about how, in their own context, they are these experts who are pushing this narrative. And then one third dimension of what they do is that they target inclusion and forced deportation kinds of issues. So they do a lot in terms of training law enforcement organizations, using law enforcement to promote anti-Muslim bigotry and fear. One example of that is the Thin Blue Line Project. They are advancing more and more calls about the FBI and DOJ increasing the surveillance of Muslim communities, all kinds of English-only, E-Verify, and other kinds of attacks on driver's license initiatives. They're going after resettlement agencies so that people fleeing violence and persecution won't have the resources that they need. And ultimately, they are constantly reinforcing the idea that refugees are national security threats. Next slide, please. So one example of how this connection is made in real lives, I want to say, but also I think while we look at organized hate movements and while we look at how that creates a context for the other things that are happening and while we are being very clear that this movement is creating some of the tension, it is also picking up on a sentiment that has been defined elsewhere. So people who are not necessarily part of these movements and people who are not necessarily conscious of that kind of language are reacting in similar ways. So one example of that is something that happened in October. And in October, there was a global rally for humanity. And that global rally for humanity, and you'll note, and it's important for us to always pay attention to this, the language that they use never talks about hate. It's always uplifting, and it's always about humanity, and it's always about America, and it's always about values. So in October, the CNC research team discovered about 20 scheduled rallies that were across the country, and they all had the same name, Global Rally for Humanity. There was no clear ringleader, but an Arizona organizer who coordinated an armed rally in May was involved in publicizing these events. They were asking people to come out on October 9th and 10th, showing force, and in fact, in some instances, encouraging people to bring their weaponry to identified mosques and or places that were serving Muslims. Or, again, because remember, this is not necessarily about limiting it to Muslims, but also those perceived as Muslim, and making sure that people understood that they were not welcome. As a result of a lot of work that CNC did in partnership with other organizations like Shoulder to Shoulder, we were able to reach out to the Muslim community in affected cities and other organizations across the country to share the information about what was going to happen so that we could organize a pushback. We worked with some key oppositional messaging talking points and made sure that they were circulated. We hopefully were able to share information with people who just wanted to do something. In this case, we shared a map, and you'll see that map. And that map essentially tracked where these events were supposed to happen. And we also did some work on the Huffington Post and worked with others to get other articles published to make sure that people were aware. And part of what I think is important to understand that we have to, while we're making people aware of what's going on, also give people something to do. And so the global rally was not, in fact, global. And the global rally was not very successful. So we were able to push back. And so I share that as an example of what we can do and how this is all doable work, so that even in the face of what is obviously very overwhelming, they have some idea that we can do this. And then finally, I wanted to share this next slide, which is how we go about doing the work. And so, again, this is about first knowing the opposition. Next slide. And that's what we do in terms of understanding what these organizations do. And then the next process of that is understanding that and defining that. And so we create some oppositional messages, and these messages are important to push back. And then to control the message, we got to know what's being said and where it is so we know when to push back. And this part, the creation of an echo chamber, which is where I think the faith community can have the strongest impact. Media defines this echo chamber as a situation in which information, ideas, or beliefs are amplified and reinforced by transmission and repetition inside a system, and where you can at the same time censor different or competing, or in this case, destructive information that is otherwise underrepresented. And so we really want to try to create lots of spaces where this rhetoric, which is destructive and dangerous, can't take hold. And I don't think there's any place more appropriate for that than in faith communities where that messaging happens often, where the call to justice happens often, for the call to love other people happens often, and can challenge the mythology, the lies, and the misinformation that is undergirding the present anti-Muslim sentiment and the anti-refugee backlash. And with that, I'll stop so we can have some time for questions.
Terry, thank you so much for both raising up the seriousness and the depth of the threats, but leaving us as well in a place where we feel encouraged and called to use our voices, particularly in the unique ways that faith communities can, to make a difference. And I am certainly reminded of a word from one of our sacred scriptures in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, where King Jehoshaphat was feeling great fear because of so many allied against him, and the word came down, don't be dismayed at the great multitude. The battle is not yours, but God's. And you indeed are pointing us back in that direction, and we know so much that Catherine Orthborn, through Shoulder to Shoulder, working there as their campaign director, engages faith communities specifically to help to ensure that indeed voices of love dominate over those of hate. And Catherine, we know you're on the line. We know you've just been in a meeting, no doubt exciting, with the Director of Homeland Security, Secretary Johnson. And please bring us up to date with what Shoulder to Shoulder is doing and call us to action for what we can do in partnership with you.
Sure. Thank you so much. It's really good to join you all and to join Sharon and Jen and Terry in talking about this important issue. So for some background, and I'm sorry if this is repetition, if I've missed it, but Shoulder to Shoulder is a coalition of 31 different religious denominations and organizations that came together to stand collectively against anti-Muslim bigotry and to promote the message that attacks on one religious community inherently damage other religious communities and damage our society as a whole. So our tagline is standing with American Muslims, upholding American values, seeing those things as happening together. We work at both national and local levels to help mobilize, educate, and equip faith leaders, institutions, and communities to stand in solidarity with the American Muslim community, which is in and of itself quite diverse, of course, but we do this through different efforts, and we do this more broadly to build bridges and to build relationships locally with our Muslim neighbors around the country. So we have 31 national organizations engaged, and we also have 44 community-based organizations around the country that are affiliated with Shoulder to Shoulder officially. And then we work in unofficial ways, of course, with many, many, many people and organizations and communities. We became engaged on the issue of Syrian refugees last fall, actually when Jen with Church World Service, which is a member of Shoulder to Shoulder, came to us asking for some collaboration on pushing back against the anti-Muslim rhetoric they were hearing already back then being directed at Syrian refugees. So since then, we've been in conversation with many of the coalition partners working on Syrian refugees and on refugee and immigration issues more broadly on this issue, helping where we can and getting their action alerts and guidance out to our network as well to help the Shoulder to Shoulder network to engage in various ways on this issue. And in many ways, the piece I want to focus on now is how the pushback against refugees is really part of this larger picture of how xenophobia and particularly the current climate of anti-Muslim sentiment is manifesting in the U.S. And like Terry, I would point to the role of pundits and politicians that are sort of creating this echo chamber playing into a climate that is ripe for anti-Muslim bigotry to show up in a lot of ways. Next slide, please. So beyond the fact that politicians from local and state to national levels have used the tragedy in Paris, and in San Bernardino and the national climate of fear to demonize and target Syrian refugees, we've seen anti-Muslim bigotry show up in a ton of other ways. We have, you know, presidential candidates suggesting things like creating registries of Muslims or doing mass surveillance, another stating that it would be impossible for a Muslim to serve as president of the U.S. They've been called out on these points, but not nearly strong enough, I would say, and I think even if they were sanctioned by their party, part of the issue here is that they say these things because it's politically profitable for them. So thinking about this, you know, feelings thermometer and different research that's been done, this one that's up on the screen right now by Public Religion Research Institute shows that a large percentage of Americans, and particularly Americans of faith communities, feel that the values of Islam are at odds with the American values and way of life. And so this sort of context is part of what feeds into the political rhetoric, these organized hate groups being able to push out this message of fear and being able to politically capitalize on it. Next slide, please. So there have also been, you know, studies showing that from some of our nation's top neuroscientists showing that Americans currently see Arabs and Muslims as somehow less human than other populations that they were asked about in a survey that they did. And this is a pretty vicious feedback loop. So politicians and pundits and these hate groups fan fear and reinforce this climate where a lack of knowledge about Islam and a lack of relationship with Muslims creates this level of ignorance that is sort of preyed upon, and it's infused with these negative narratives. So instead of being at sort of a zero when it comes to knowledge about Islam and Muslims, many people go to like a negative 50, I would say. And then so we have a lot of work to do to bring it back up and then bring it into the positive. So what are the communities of faith doing right now? Well, they're doing a lot. And I think that even though the climate feels very difficult and dismal right now, we've been really encouraged to see how eager people are to push back against the hate and fear-mongering all around the country. So the October rallies that Terry mentioned, you know, there were a number of these mosque protests planned around the nation, and we were thankful to Center for New Community for tracking those and helping us to identify where those were planned so that we could start conversations with our member denominations and then communicate with people around the country to help connect them with the local Muslim communities if they weren't already, and with other interfaith allies in the area to figure out the best local response. So one of the things that happened, and I pull up this this Huffington Post article to sort of show that what ended up happening is that these rallies ended up inspiring acts of love and service, essentially. So all around the country, we were able to connect with interfaith activists, human rights activists, all sorts of different folks who came together and were able to organize in partnership with the local Muslim communities and to push back against this and really to try to tell a different narrative. So I think one of my favorite examples was in Amarillo, Texas, where a Unitarian Universalist minister was sort of my point of contact there. He organized, I think, 10 different congregations in the Amarillo area in partnership with the community that was being targeted there, which was actually a community center rather than a mosque. It was a community center that a Muslim donor had put his name on, and that's the center that was being targeted. And so instead of the news covering a bunch of armed protesters standing out there, the news was able to cover a gathering of over 100 interfaith people who came to stand with the local Muslim community. And then I think it was either one or two folks showed up who were there for the protest, and they were dressed in KKK paraphernalia. They had Confederate flags. They had weapons, and they had anti-Islam signs. And what the news story showed, which I think really resonated with a lot of the American public, was this massive pushback against the very overt signs of hate. And I think that a thing that stood out to me with this is that when the American public really is able to see this hate in very overt ways and see it for what it is, Americans push back widely. I mean, of course, there are still parts of the American public that that will still promote sort of these extremist and hateful messages, and those are many of the groups that Terry was talking about. But I think that the general public, when they see it for what it is, they push back. And so part of the work we are doing through Shoulder to Shoulder and in partnership with so many other groups and community-based organizations, grassroots organizations around the U.S., is to really help to tell that story. And it involves people, physically going out there to stand in support with the Muslim community when there's an incident like this, when they're being targeted. So this is sort of part of the rapid response work that we do in order to shift this narrative to a solidarity narrative and to a, we're all in this together sort of narrative. The internal work we do in religious communities in the U.S. is really critical as well. So to that end, we partner with, as we're able, member denominations to provide education, resources, and tools for internal education, reflection, and growth. Because inside many of our religious communities, as we saw from that slide we showed with the Public Religion Research Institute data on how fearful about Islam, is that we have internal in communities to help to change that. We also help support some of the ongoing, deeper, more proactive rather than just reactive work going on around the country, because once those bonds are sort of built in communities, that makes the rapid response work a lot easier to coordinate. You're not meeting people for the first time to come stand with them in solidarity against an act of hate, but rather they're your friends. They're people that you communicate with on a regular basis, and it's a lot easier to figure out what it looks like to stand together when some of the organized hate groups are doing things, out there in public. So I think that one of the pieces of data that I'm sure many people have seen is how if people know Muslims, they are much more likely to have a positive image of Islam and Muslims in the U.S. And so an example of what we're doing around this is that we're currently working with folks in Irving, Texas, which has been sort of a hot spot for a lot of the anti-Muslim protests, and there's been major issues with the mayor there really being turning against the Muslim community locally. So at the request of the Islamic Center, we've helped convene a growing cohort of local clergy. I think we have 10 local clergy now, and then lay leaders from different religious communities in Irving who are working with to plan an event next weekend, actually, to support them in crafting what they can do in terms of deeper long-term work in building up their community relationships. So next weekend, next Saturday, there's a protest planned for the Islamic Center of Irving, but there's also a solidarity event planned there that has a huge number of folks that are planning planning to turn out for it. And then on Sunday is when we have, 10 different faith communities from Irving that the clergy have committed to bringing members of their congregation to the Islamic Center of Irving to have a conversation and to do some community building and relationship building work that they're going to continue to build on in the days ahead. Because that's really, in the long term, what creating more inclusive societies is about is just doing that that sort of nitty-gritty work of building the relationships. And so those are sort of the ways we focus on helping plug communities of faith into advocating on this issue, so through both rapid response and helping with some of the longer-term work. And that really is dependent on local congregations and communities being willing to do it. So we rely really on those who are motivated to do work locally, and we connect, we educate, we mobilize, and we network those folks. So I'll end with some specific ways to be engaged with Shoulder to Shoulder, and then certainly am open for questions after this. But for individuals, we have a mailing list to communicate about some of the opportunities we do, and you can connect to us to be sort of part of our database of folks that we have in various parts of the country that we can call upon if a local action is needed or if somebody's planning a local action and they want to share it with a broader community of folks who want to stand in solidarity with their Muslim neighbors. We also have a community membership network that organizations or congregations can join. This network meets by phone periodically, and we have a listserv for ongoing online communications between the different groups so that folks can share sort of best practices. They can share challenges and hear from others in the group about how they dealt with a similar challenge in their local community. And there's opportunities to be involved in nationwide sort of pushes through that network. This is something that, groups can join, and it's a way of being part of a larger network working explicitly on anti-Muslim bigotry from a faith community angle. So I'm going to stop there. There's much more I could say, but I know our time is short, and I want to make sure there's plenty of time for questions. So thank you very much. Catherine, thank you so much. And we'll move ahead to the next slides and see if we can go through them very quickly. Also, I invite you to go to the conversation cloud that is up above the center of the three bright green dots. Click on that, and you can see a number of resources that we've been adding in throughout the presentations this afternoon. We just want to point very quickly to some specific faith community pushback resources that we have, videos that are available, as you can see, for faith communities. At the hashtags that are being used, Love Thy Neighbor, Lift My Lamp, a number of clergy op-eds that have been developed, and we want to especially put the word out that if you are in a community that perhaps your church has a positive relationship with a local Islamic community center or is interested in doing that, let us know. Contact anyone in the IIC, and there are sample op-eds that we can provide. Look to organize local vigils. We'll go to the next slide and begin to see some images from some recent vigils, and we'll go on farther. We continue to encourage, as we had lifted up in the last webinar as well, the resources that we have available for a welcome weekend if you would like to uplift in your worship service or in other ways in your faith community or broader community refugees. You can see welcome weekend resources at the link that is provided specifically for vigils and for dinners. We have a specialized toolkit for that. We encourage you to hold press conferences. Those press conferences, as was mentioned, both by Terry and by Catherine, often are what end up gratefully grabbing the headline over and above negative shouting. So please look to do that, and that continues to serve as an important groundswell of pushback against anti-refugee and anti-immigrant rhetoric. We also can continue to share those with all of our faith leaders as well. And get your faith communities
engaged, move them towards advocacy also by encouraging them to do things such as gathering refugee hospitality kits, like this great young teenager that you see in the picture in Pennsylvania that did this recently. We'll go to the next slide. Again, we underline op-ed helps that are available, and we want to point you towards some particular really large-level letters that have recently gone in to legislators, from evangelical leaders, from multi-faith community leaders, including a very, very high number of our highest-level faith leaders who are signed on to the one that you can find there on the Interfaith Immigration website. Just last week, 1,000 rabbis signed a letter. What a magnificent celebration. And then we encourage you to consider taking these letters and petitions that have been signed to your local legislators. We'll move on.
Could you email these slides to us?
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. We will email to everyone after the call today all of these slides so that hopefully you can pick up each of these links that are referred to in the great resources our speakers shared. Again, this is the link that you see to the state-by-state resources, a beautiful picture from a local event that was just held, a multicultural Thanksgiving dinner and press conference in Greensboro. The image at the bottom is the one you'll see on the IIC website when you go to look for the state-by-state resources, and we'll go forward to the next slide. If we can, we'll move the next slide, but I think that there we go. We see here some other images of just last Saturday, amazing event in Falls Church, Virginia, that began at a Christian church location, went and continued to an Islamic center, multiplied the voice that was raised up of love through holding a press conference at the start, also used the event to gather blankets for refugees in the coming cold season. And we really would love to see this type of event consistently multiplied. We'll go to the next slide. We know that recently over 100 New Jersey religious leaders pushed back when a statement was made by Governor Christie without support for Syrian refugees, even including orphans under age 5. So thank you for faith community responses back to that. We encourage you to partner with Syrian-led organizations. In the chat box today, we listed a number of them from around the country. You see a picture here of the Syrian American Council's new Meet a Refugee campaign. You may consider contacting them, learning more about that campaign, and partnering together with them. To the next slide, we're reminded of things that our Iowa partners and faith leaders have been doing to push back against their leaders who were not welcoming to Syrians in their state. We thank you for that. And with that, we'll go to the final slide, which invites you into asking discussion, engaging in discussion, asking your questions. And we invite you, if you would like to type your question, to go to the middle chat green button, bright green button at the top, and consider emailing your question. Or if you would press *6, you're able to unmute yourself at this time and ask your question verbally. So we invite your questions and responses. And as you are formulating your questions, we also invite you to consider doing something that is a simple statement but a profound message to your community, to consider using your church sign to raise up that refugees are welcome in your congregation. Make pictures and posters that have messages that your faith calls you to welcome refugees. Put your location on it. Stand in front of your church sign if you can. Take those pictures and send, again, as we said earlier, send all of the information of the fabulous work that we know is happening throughout the country through each of your faith communities, send that information to Megan Cagle, M-C-A-G-L-E, at cwsglobal.org, and it will be posted to join the other amazing array of faith community resources. Are there questions that folks would like to ask? Again, you can press star 6 or type it in the chat function. Well, I would like to ask Catherine if you are at liberty to tell us, how did your meeting this afternoon earlier go?
Sure. So it's actually still going on. I'm going to pop back into it in a few minutes, and they're going to do a press conference, I believe, soon. But it's a group of Muslims and interfaith partners meeting with the Secretary of Homeland Security, and it actually has, the part that I have been in thus far has gone really well. He talked a lot about the importance of that vilifying American Muslims is going to do nothing for protecting our homeland security, and that's something that he said on the record and is going to be saying to the press. He also, you know, spoke up about the fact that the rest of the American public needs to wake up to the discrimination that American Muslims are facing, and reiterated the point that if they see it for what it is, then they'll know that it's un-American and that it doesn't reflect our values, and really reiterated the point that, you know, his job in protecting homeland security means protecting homeland security for all people and against all forms of extremism. So, you know, we're talking about many forms of extremism in this conversation, and the challenge that it is to work against that, but the problem of, he was very strong on the problem of anti-Muslim bigotry in the U.S. So it was good to hear him speak so strongly and on the record about that.
Great. Thank you so much. And we are getting some other questions we'll cover quickly that are in our chat box. And thank you so much for this. We had a question, and perhaps this can go first to Terry and then maybe as well to Catherine. Are there faith communities in the U.S. which oppose refugees from Syria? One of our viewers is asking, because of some resistance to welcoming refugees that she has seen, and is wondering whether some faith communities are trying to shape a theological argument of some sort against refugees in a perverted way.
This is Terry. I don't know of a faith community that is shaping a message against refugees, except that there are clearly some Christians who are mobilizing against Muslims. And so it's an interesting question. I don't know I cannot identify a specific organization or congregation that's doing it, but I know that there's certainly an undercurrent for a lot of Christians who are uncomfortable with the Muslim community and the Muslim refugee community and those perceived as Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, anything you might like to add or perhaps related, I think, of Liberty University connected comments from this weekend or elsewhere?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, there aren't really denominational pushbacks against Syrian refugees from what I've seen. I could be overlooking some, but I think that certainly voices coming out of Liberty University have been very concerning on this front, and I would point to Reverend Franklin Graham as one of the, you know, very loud Christian voices that has spoken out against refugees or has spoken for accepting only Christian refugees, so putting sort of a religious test on who gets into the United States. And he has a big following. So there have definitely been some influential, you know, faith leaders who have spoken on that side of the issue, but I think that what has been encouraging is that we've seen so many of the organized faith communities, from the conservative to the liberal side of the spectrum. I mean, the Southern Baptist Convention spoke out in favor of letting more refugees in, as did the National Association for Evangelicals and many others that would be sort of considered part of the moderate to conservative religious camp. So I think that overall we've seen much of the faith community pushing towards being more open to refugees, but we've seen a couple of religious pundits sort of speaking a different message as well.
Great. And we can certainly refer folks to the interfaithimmigration.org site to see a number of faith community statements and support of refugees. We also have a question from another viewer about interested to find out further information related to organizations in Colorado that are promoting Muslim-Christian partnerships.
So I think maybe I'll jump in there, and then if others have things to add. But there are a number of different groups engaged in work in Colorado. I know I'm not sure if the person is in Colorado Springs or Denver or some other area, but I know quite a few groups and individuals in Denver that are working on this, and I'm connecting with some of them later today and tomorrow as well. And then there's an organization that actually has its headquarters in Colorado called Peace Catalyst International that specifically works on Muslim-Christian relationship building. And while they work nationally and actually internationally, they're based in Denver, and they would be very good to connect with for to figure out what they're doing on the Muslim-Christian front specifically in Colorado. But if somebody wants to reach out to me by email, I'm happy to make further connections to folks doing work there.
Great. All right, and we have also some other questions that are coming through. A resource, is there a resource to connect with local organizations? I think we will continue to work on developing that, particularly as it will help faith communities link with Muslim and other Syrian refugee organizations. We listed in the chat feature earlier a number of different names of Syrian American organizations working to assist communities. Do you have others that you all would like to point hearers to? Other lists of resource organizations around the country? Do you have that on either of your websites, Terry or Catherine?
This is Catherine. On our website, we have a community membership map that shows the official communities that have joined Shoulder to Shoulder as community members. But beyond those folks who have officially affiliated as members, we know lots of people in different parts of the country who we can connect folks with depending on what exactly it is that they're looking for. So folks can certainly reach out to me if that map doesn't answer the questions that they have.
And Catherine, some folks are hoping to be able to watch the press conference that you referred to that is upcoming, wondering if that might be posted as a link on the Facebook site, perhaps for Shoulder to Shoulder.
That is the hope, and I actually have to jump off the call to go back to that now, but I will certainly let Sharon know and then have folks send it around, and we'll be posting things on the Shoulder to Shoulder Facebook page as well.
Great. Thank you.
And
I ask everyone to look. There's a comment by one of our viewers about a wonderful Thursday evening event coming up in the city of Chicago's Public Library at 6 p.m. this week. We'll try to get that posted with other resources as well. And as a final question, one of our viewers is asking, and Terry, we'll send this to you, what are the best practices to counter political contenders who are racist and anti-immigrant?
I see you saved the easy question for me.
That was an easy one, right?
Thank you. So again, similarly, as I shared earlier, we have to start pushing back. And so I think part of the reason that we know that part of the reason they're doing this is that it has been shown over and over that during the election season, which gets increasingly longer in our lives as Americans, this kind of stuff heightens, and it gets more and more obvious, and it gets more and more real, and people it works for some people. I don't know how long it works, but if in many different places as we can to push back against that stuff, to call people out. And this is going to play itself out on the local level as well. I think we frequently look at the national level, but we also need to start spending some time at the local level. And so as many different ways as we can come up with and places in, that we can say, no, that's just inappropriate. Not only is the language racist, and say the word racist out loud, that's the other thing we tend not to do, but also weigh in at newspapers and remind reporters who are just spewing the same rhetoric to challenge them as well. So op-eds and letters to the editor is another way that we can do this. Certainly, when we are doing our voter education, we can talk to people about what the truth of these people's motivations are. They are not upholding American values. They are trying to maintain a system of privilege and oppression. We also have developed some talking points around the refugee resettlement, and I'll make sure that I get that to all of you so that the messages have to be clean, because the challenge, particularly in the soundbite world that we live in, is that you got to get the message short and sweet. And so we have spent some time on that, and I'll make sure that you have some of that information. We are also around as a resource to help you craft. If there's some local stuff that you're seeing, we can help with that as well. And finally, I don't think we can underestimate the power of social media. So Facebook and Twitter are also places that we can push back and push back as quickly as they spew their hatred.
Wonderful. Thank you. And another of our hearers has referred us to the Shoulder to Shoulder website for anti-Muslim bigotry resources in terms of the theological argument in question that had been brought up earlier. An additional participant with us in the call, our brother Luis Alfredo in New York City, is reminding us that tonight, starting now till 8:30, there is a meeting called I Am a Muslim, Not a Terrorist, at 199 Chambers Street in New York. So please consider joining that. Other events, read all the chat comments. What a great and fruitful, robust conversation it has been. Thank you to each one of our speakers for your excellent information. What a joy it is to continue to work in partnership. We have so much work to do in this week to make sure messages of love can dominate and that votes indeed can help to uphold our U.S. refugee program so that we can continue to support the world's most vulnerable communities. We want to give a special thanks again in prayers to be with each of our overworked and highly knowledgeable speakers who have been with us today, Jen Smyers, and to Terry Johnson, and to Catherine Osborne. We appreciate you deeply. We're glad to be in the fight for justice together with each one of you. Continue to check in with interfaithimmigration.org website. We will send you all information from this webinar. We hear what you were saying in the chat box that we will make sure that everyone's photo will not block the slides in future presentations, and may each of you be guided by the strength of God in your work. Thank you again so much for being with us. Bye-bye.